had mentioned earlier when we were talking about how you started on Broadway right before COVID hit, and how that being on stage, that first show when you came back, I'd like to hear about the emotion of walking into the theater that day when it started up again, walking back onto stage in front of an audience who has likely been itching to get out and do something, but also at the same time seeing that that audience is not full because there's the spacing in the seats and whatever else they did to accommodate whatever needed to be done at the time, and what that was, and also how that relates or is different to the first time you walked out onto a Broadway stage, the first time you walked into the building knowing you're on tonight, and the first time you walked out in front of that audience, and here I am.
I will say my Broadway debut was like a President's Day matinee. So it was like a Monday matinee, which Monday matinees are always just filled with a bunch of people who are kind of like vaguely confused because they like bought a ticket, but you're like, it's Monday. What is this? So it was like people who were like, oh, okay, we're going to see Wicked. And then my family and friends who were like losing their minds. The other thing is when I first joined, especially since it had been a really long time since I had been in like a show, I had been working as a director and a choreographer, a lot of other things, and I performed in concerts, but it'd been a really long time since I'd like done a show. And I had also never been a replacement in a show. So my experience in doing theater up until that point was everyone rehearsing together and then having the same opening night. And when you join, when you're a replacement in a long running show, be it a national tour or on Broadway, you rehearse with just like you and the dance captain and a piano player for like a couple of weeks. And then you'll have one spacing rehearsal where you go out and meet and touch everybody for the first time and do all of those musical numbers and see where you're supposed to fit in between these people you've heard about and you've seen them do the show, but you haven't done it with them. And then you'll have what they call a put-in rehearsal where you're fully in costume and microphone and makeup and wigs, and everyone else is in street clothes and kind of like texting and thinking about what they're going to do for dinner and see if maybe they'll go take Pilates after this. And that is traumatizing and feels like a car accident happened. So by the time I was doing the show and I was up there and it was happening, like, I mean, fully that hyper-focused ADHD for me was like on like overdrive, trying to just make sure that I was in the right places, doing all of the right things. Cause also I had never done it with lighting. So you're not doing it with all of the lights and the full orchestra, all of that stuff. You're not doing it until the show is happening. So that is a really crazy thing to happen as well. Cause there's many times where you're like run into the wings here and you're like, oh, and there's lights in your face. Surprise.
I can't see.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's a whole different experience. And then I fully wasn't able to like be still and recognize that I was making my Broadway debut until halfway through Dancing Through Life, where I have this moment where I have to stand and like hold a freeze. And I remember like looking at this like little nail in the set and I was like, I'm making my Broadway debut right now. What? And so that was like its own experience and super overwhelming, but it did feel kind of like intimate. And then when we reopened Broadway, coming back in and singing with everyone for the first time after not seeing them for a full year and a half was so emotional. You know, this thing that for me is such an integral part of my life and so important to me and my life and my experience as being a human and what it means to be a human to me, which is art and expression and music coming together, to be in that room with all of those people and to sing through the score for the first time was completely overwhelming. And everyone was so emotional, and we have a the New York Times there, and we were all sitting in our chairs, like spaced out. And it literally was just to like vocally run through the show. And like a full like anxiety, and I was a mess and I was crying, and it was unbelievable. And then a couple of weeks later, when we had one invitational dress with a small audience, and then we had our opening night. And that opening night, I mean, it was like getting punched in the face with a wall of sound from that audience when we came out and started to sing. Like, I couldn't hear me because the audience was so loud in their cheers. And then you have Glinda come down in the bubble and she says, "It's good to see me, isn't it?" And everyone was like,
people lost it.
Crying. I mean, it was, our show was running 15 minutes longer than normal because of like applause breaks and people just being so overjoyed and overwhelmed to be back in the theater. Because for a huge portion of people from New York, and I would say the tri-state area, going to live theater, going to see Broadway shows is like a core part of your identity. And to have that not be something that you had access to for that long was, I don't think people fully realized how much they missed the experience of that live communal experience of everyone's heartbeat syncing up and going on that emotional journey together with 2,000 other people, if not more, depending on the performance space. You know, I don't think people quite realize how much they missed that until they were back in the Broadway houses again. And it was completely unbelievable to be there. And I will never forget it as long as I live. And it was such a crazy day on top of it. We performed on the Today Show in the morning. So I was up at like 4:30 in the morning. I was up at 4:30 in the morning to then go and perform on the Today Show. And then we were bussed back to the theater and I went and took a nap. And then we were invited to go do the Ham for Ham with all of the other Broadway shows that were opening. And I was like, this is never going to happen for me again. I should definitely go do this. And somehow ended up standing next to Lin-Manuel Miranda, which I was there first. He stood next to me. So I wasn't trying to be a creep. And then, you know, and then going to the show and having that experience that night. It was just like, it was just such an incredible day that I'm so, 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 so grateful I got to experience, unlike anything I've ever experienced. And also the nice thing about it was that we didn't have any restrictions on the audience. The audience was jam-packed in there. The only thing was that they had to be in masks, mm-hmm. and that was it.
Right.
But that was the only mandate. People didn't have to distance. And that was, I think that was a big reason why it took so long for Broadway to come back, is they were like, there's no point if we can't pack a house, because it fundamentally changes the experience if you're not next to people.
That's true.
Hearing you say this reminds me, it was June of 21 where concerts started again in New York. And mm-hmm. I saw Trey at the Beacon when he was one of the earliest shows. I think Foo Fighters and then Trey were the two earliest shows opening New York up again. And the impression being in the audience was that this meant something to him on stage. And I don't remember, I think he played with some other people as well, but it felt like it was more than just a show. And hearing you talk about your experience and that coming back, that it wasn't just the audience who felt something, it was the performers as well, where there was a lot of meaning for them, for you, that it wasn't normal. It wasn't just another show. It was an experience.
Absolutely. And Glinda has this little monologue at the end of the show that is the same. This is what it's been since 2003, where she says, "We fellow Aussians, we've been through a frightening time, and there will be other times and other things that frighten us." And my husband, after the show was over, he said, "Did they write some of that?" And I was like, "No, that is what it has been." And it
took on new relevance.
Absolutely. And that's the other thing that's been such an incredible part of being in Wicked, especially right now, where and through all of my time being there, where it is unfortunately constantly relevant. Mm-hmm. And people understand the meanings, and it's shifting in what its meaning is, but it is always relevant. And to get up there every night and tell a story that has real meaning to it and really connects with people. And then to get to be a part of the film, which is much more accessible to more people and also demonstrates accessibility in different ways, you know, casting Marissa Bodhi as Nessa and getting to see Elphaba played by Cynthia Erivo. I mean, it's just such a privilege to be a part of such powerful art, because it's all I ever wanted to do. And now I'm doing it.
It's nice to see, like, living the dream exactly as you want to be doing it.
Yeah.
And the way I actually found you was I was doing some scrolling on Instagram, and your reel came up just through scrolling of you singing for Defying Gravity along with the rest of the ensemble. And it was right before her big last final note.
Do it, Michelle.
No. I did it for him right before, but I can't sing. You wrote, I think your caption was like, "I was in the room where it happened," which we thought was very clever. But what was it like for you to be in that room where it happened, of being part of those vocalists to sing the most defining song probably of the year for the biggest movie to date of the year?
Yeah, it was, well, it's so funny. So I had received a phone call from Stephen Aremus, who is the music supervisor for the film and is the music supervisor for Broadway as well. And, you know, all of the music, the orchestration, all of that, not necessarily the orchestration, but like the choral parts and stuff, all of that comes together with Stephen Schwartz and Stephen Aremus working together. It was his idea to do Dear Old Shins. Like, his little fingerprints are all over Wicked. And I had gotten a call from him saying, "Hey, we're putting together a little group to do some demo stuff for the film in August of 2022. And I was just thinking, oh, I'll go in and record some things to teach other people how to sing soprano too. Great. And then I went into the session and I was like in this little waiting room. And as I'm sitting on the floor, Stephen Schwartz walks in, and I was like, well, I would have worn a different outfit if I knew you were going to be here. And he explained, because I had never I'd never been a part of like a vocal anything for a motion picture before. And so he explained, you know, we're laying down the demos. So this is what we're using to build the movie off of for set tempos, rehearsals, choreography, everything for the cinematographers, all of that. This might be what we end up using in the movie, or we might bring in a larger ensemble later down the road. And I was like, what? Huh? Okay, great. And so we went in and we just sang all of the stuff that we knew already. And so I was singing all of the parts that I sing at night. And then that continued. We continued to have sessions sporadically over the course of like a year and a half or so. And then I eventually got to the point where we were having, okay, it's the big recording day. We're bringing in 24 singers. Because the initial demo group, it was just one person on each part. It was six of us in the room. And they had brought in people to do demo work for some of the other things before they ever had anybody in the recording studio. So people were laying down demos for like some of the Nessa vocals and Bach and all of these other things, any of the new musical numbers that they were working on for the second film or any of that, they were bringing in people to work on that. And so, but the ensemble, it was just six singers. And they would kind of like describe what the plan was for what was going to be happening on film. So I had been hearing what the plan was, doing the show at night, hearing what the plan was for the film for over a year. And then it was May of 2024 And we showed up and it was this huge group.
Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save with customized coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, no, it's the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Of singers. And then on top of it, there were monitors for us to see what was happening on film. Mm-hmm. So the coolest part of this whole thing was literally these little monitors that were set up that showed what was happening on screen. And then underneath, there was the measure number and the beat, so that you could follow along exactly where you were in the music with what was happening on screen. And so we got to see a almost fully edited version of the film for each one of these numbers that we were doing. It was just the numbers that we were singing on as the ensemble, but to help bring the vocal energy. And so this show, getting to see the film representation and the film version of what I'm doing every night, and then also what I had been hearing about was the plan for over a year, was mind blown. And I'm like crying, left, like all over the place, like, get it together, come on. Like, no streaky mascara here. Also, there was like a documentary crew film there, and I was like, don't look like a lunatic. But to see all of the culmination of all of that happening was mind blowing. And like you said, it was like, oh, I'm in the middle of one of the biggest moments of my life right now. I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. And I signed an NDA, so I can't even tell anyone about it. But to be there and to be in those moments, and then to see, because, you know, in the stage show, the momentum of it is so incredible, but you are left to your imagination on a lot of it. And then to see Cynthia singing that song, to hear her take. And I have been a fan of Cynthia Erivo's for a very long time. I saw her 3 times in the revival of The Color Purple and was an absolute train wreck mess each time I saw it. Like, just full tears, snot, everything. Like, are you okay? And the answer was no, I was not okay. Because she was such an incredibly powerful performer. And I had never seen anything like that before in front of me. And I knew that she was going to do such an amazing job with Alphaba. And then to get to see her version of Defying Gravity, I was a mess. I was an absolute mess watching it. Because to also see a female character that was just completely owning her power and not making excuses for it. Once again, it's like unlike anything I've ever seen in my life. You know, I remember these moments in film and media where it's like, wait a minute, I've never seen that before. I've never seen this before in a film. And to just see her be so incredible was such a privilege. And then I had to keep my mouth shut about it. And then I got to like sing my little soprano 2 line. And I was like, I'm a tiny little part of this. I can't believe this is happening.
Simon spoke to the emotion of hearing the songs in the room, of watching on his 7-inch monitor and hearing those songs as they're, I was going to say, as they're being created. The song exists, but this version of it is new, and getting to be a part of that and know that this is one of those big moments that you just said, that recognizing you're living through one of the biggest moments of your life, that hearing people talk about being in those emotional moments, it speaks to the interestingness of the work that you're doing and how music and song and sound is timeless. And we said in the last one, exists across time and culture, that there's a reason why there's always been music and art and song that people are moved by.
Oh, absolutely. And it also speaks to just sort of like the genius that is Stephen Schwartz, and the fact that, you know, he's writing all of these new things, but as he's exploring and finding these things, he's not only tapping into things that already exist within, you know, he's not looking to do a brand new thing. He's like, okay, let's look at the way that Beethoven does things. Cause you think, you know, Beethoven feels really powerful. So he's looking at the way that Beethoven sometimes structured chords. And then he's also looking at, since this is the Wizard of Oz flipped on its head, or, you know, the camera pans over to the side, like finding little musical moments and being able to create certain things and pull from that and not make it so obvious, but build it into the world of the way that this music is written. So that while, yes, it's brand new and it's this version of it is new, it all still feels very familiar, whether it's that unlimited theme being a different version of Somewhere Over the Rainbow being built into Defying Gravity and her unlimited theme. And then also little Glinda being like, no, stick to the path. Like, don't, you're being unreasonable. You need to stick to the path. And that is another version of Follow the Yellow Brick Road. You know, I mean, there's just all sorts of things that are in there that is so intelligent, very intelligent design in the way that this music works and why it hits us the way that it does. Just such an honor to like be in the room and watch him work and have him be like, no, well, why don't we flip this? Or you, actually, could you go up to this note and then you be on that note instead? No, that doesn't work. Never mind. Go back to the way that it was. And like being in there as we were doing all of the demo stuff and just kind of hearing that. And then also when we were in there with the big ensemble, where he's like, you sound great, but it doesn't sound, I want you to look at what's happening on screen. It needs to sound like that's the movement that you're doing. And Or do you see this person? I want to hear that vocalized out of someone. Let's, you know, or Alyssa, could you see the way that that girl walking by is doing that? Could you, well, do a take this time. I want you to think like her. And it just was so cool to see the way that all of these things are coming together. And then to see the way that his mind works and the intense and deep understanding that he has of the material he's been working on, because he's been a part of it for so long. And that's the other thing about it, is this is the same, it's the same team of people. It's the same producers from the Broadway production. It's the same writers with an additional script writer. But it's just, it's the same group of people who have loved this story for decades, continuing to get to tell it in another version. And you can absolutely see the love and the passion and the understanding of what the material is and what makes the Broadway show so successful.
Something I found collectively about Wicked is that people are just so are drawn to the material, and there's something inspiring, capturing about it that it sounds like there's so much passion in there, whether it's we're speaking with you. Certainly in the interviews, I see that the cast members of the movie are just, they're drawn to the plot, the characters within. It has its relatable aspects, and it's just, there's so much passion involved.
Definitely. And I think that because it is this thing that isn't so overutilized in a lot of media, whether it's about female friendship, about female power, it being a flashy, colorful musical that is a fantasy, you know, and you see fantasy, but it's like it lives in these kind of distinctly masculine realms a lot of the time. And so to see this thing that is more inclusive to a larger group of people than what is just typically available out there, and people who have felt excluded from certain things at certain media feeling more included in this. And then on top of it, I think everyone has felt othered in their life at some point and has either had to kind of like squash those feelings and like learn to conform, or, you know, you've had fantasies of what it would have been like to just own your power and be your best self. And maybe you were someone who did that, but that means that you would connect to Elphaba even more. And then the political climate that we're in right now, it makes sense to people. And going back to even original Frank Baum's books, I mean, he was so inspired by the women in his life who were suffragettes and wanting to include a lot of very strong female characters and playing with gender in a way that was truly unprecedented for the time. I mean, he has a character in one of his books. It's not the first Oz book, but in the second one, I think, who is this boy and then is revealed at the end to be Ozma, who is the Queen of Oz, but has been concealed and didn't even know her own identity and has been concealed as a boy, as a witch. And so we're like fully playing with gender in ways that are even kind of interesting for now. And I think people have connected to that for a really long time. And then you also have the beauty of the 1939 movie and it being so splashy. And even though it's not the first colored film, it's what people think is the first colored film. And so, you know, it's just the thing that really made the impression because they did it so well with Technicolor. And the music being a part of the American Great American Songbook and just so woven into the fabric of our culture in so many different ways. You know, for so many of us, like when you first start taking voice lessons as a young girl, one of the first songs you're given is Somewhere Over the Rainbow to learn. And so I think that people are connected to it deeply. Deeply, whether it be just because you grew up watching the 1939 movie, or it be because you resonate with these themes on many, many different levels. But like even my brother took my niece and nephew to go see it. And my nephew loved it. Oh my gosh, he loved it so much. And then my niece, who even though she had seen the stage show a couple of times, you know, and always sort of really loved Glinda and, you know, loved Glinda and loved the pink and loved Popular. And she loves her pink dresses I bought for her from all of like the Wicked collabs and whatever. But seeing the film version, all of a sudden this like switch happened where she was able to see how powerful Cynthia Erivo was. And now it's like this obsession over both of them and seeing how unabashedly and powerful and taking leadership position and not making excuses for other people's poor behavior is now inspiring my 8-year-old niece. And like, that's not something I grew up with. And she gets to grow up with that. It's phenomenal.
And you get to be a part of it.
Yeah.
So something that we've discussed in the podcast is becoming a part of people's stories, whether it's us with our patients or musicians and their songs and how their songs can be kind of woven into people's lives. You talked earlier about at times feeling like a role model for other women. And I'm curious for you if there have been times where you felt like you became a part of somebody's story and what that was for you.
I think that there's something really incredible about being in this ensemble in particular in many different ways, whether it be the fact that I get to take my niece and nephew backstage and show them that like not only is like this like a really cool thing that I do, but also it is an attainable thing that I do. Like it is possible to have this as a job. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a lot of pride that happens there where they get to feel like, oh, that's my aunt and my auntie Meg does this and she does that and feeling like I'm a part of their story. But then also on the other side of it, like being in the room, being in the dressing room that I am in with the women that I am with, has been so important to me at this juncture, whether it be that I am learning from them and learning through the way that they care for themselves and the way that they treat other people. And then also being someone who is on the older side of the young people who are in the cast, you know, I'm in a different place than a lot of other people are. And in my time at Wicked, have learned so much about my own strength that is there, not only because of dealing with injuries and having to get up and do the show every night, but I also have been on a long infertility journey mm-hmm. at the theater. And I was thinking about this the other day, and when I look back, oh, I'm crying, how stupid. When I look back at this time in my life, there is no way for my time at Wicked to not be woven in at this point in my life. As I've gone through IVF in this dressing room with these other women who are so inspiring to me, and they take such good care of themselves and they take such good care of me. And to know that everything that I'm doing is not only making it so that I can become a mother and have a family, but also is showing all of these other women that I work with that, like, we're all capable of so much. As I'm like literally doing shots in the dressing room. Mm-hmm. And have a Sharps container at my station for like hormonal shots and things like that. And to, you know, just be pushing and doing what feels like super, super insane things, but I have a goal in mind and this is what needs to be done. And therefore, I guess this is what I'm going to do. And it's funny to be there now because like, there's such a wide varying ages. There's people who are in their early 20s in this that I share a dressing room with, and then people who are closer in age to me in their mid 30s. But I am like, I just turned 40 this past year. And I like, if anyone is dealing with anything or health wise and their own bodies and, or they're thinking, you know, we're thinking we might want kids, but I was just diagnosed with this and da da da. And it's like, I've become this like, person who is like a go-to person to talk to about these things because they've all witnessed me go through all of this. And I'd like to think I've done it with strength and grace. I think I've mostly done it with that and generally a good attitude, but I know that I am showing them like that if you're not getting the right answers that you, or you're feeling like you're getting the right answers, you just can kind of keep plugging along. Because also, you know, as much like literally all of this has been tied at the same time. I started infertility treatments right when Broadway reopened. Mm-hmm. And now I'm at a point where we finally have like some embryos in a freezer, but it's just like, it like the fight with the insurance companies and the fight with doctor's offices and trying to get someone to listen to me and trying to advocate for myself and learning how to advocate for myself. And it's just been so overwhelming to think about how I've done all of this at the same time while doing 8 shows a week. But I also think it happened at the same time on purpose because I've never had to care for myself this much. I'm like, really having to care for myself.
It's ironic that in this quest to become a mother, you've become a motherly figure, it sounds like, to a room full of women.
Yeah.
And it's in a job like this, it is impossible, I would expect, for it to not be interwoven your personal life and your professional life, that it is so consuming and you have so much interaction with these people around you that it is inevitable that you're going to be mutual support for each other in times of need. So yeah. It seems like you work with an incredible group of people and that you have become a source of comfort and help to them. What a wonderful environment to be a part of.
I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful. I've never been, I've never had community with women in this way. And it's just so funny to think about the show that we're doing and how there's such strong women in it. And I get to have such strong bonds with so many incredible women. And I get to go, you know, I get to go do that 8 times a week. I'm so grateful.
Thinking about the idea of just doing the injections that you need to do, even if you say nothing, there's a normalizing element to that, that if somebody else sees you doing that, fertility-related issues, pregnancy loss, all of that, it's something that's so often not talked about, yet so many people are experiencing it and dealing with it, that having kind of that quiet normalization of it maybe opens the door for somebody else to be comfortable in sharing what their experience is and just kind of getting it out. And I can only imagine that you only know a part of the influence that that has on others.
I hope, exactly like you said, like that is my hope, that I can help to normalize this, because I went into this like blind. I had had one friend who had done a little bit of stuff, but it never really resulted in anything. But it was just was one of those things where we couldn't figure out what was going on. And I am such a chronic like oversharer anyway, that I was like, well, there's no way I'm going to keep this a secret. So I'm just going to talk about this very loudly with everyone so that you all know where I'm at. And also, like, you know, there's only so much you can try to keep private in a room where there's just so much intimacy. We're all changing in front of each other. We're like, it's not a normal job to have. And so to think that you can kind of like completely close yourself off and also deprive yourself of that community, it just makes it impossible to even get the job done. Like, we can do the job because there is this sense of community. And so I just almost felt the sense of responsibility of talking about all of this, because of the fact that I only after I started talking about it found out from other people what their stories were. And I was like, they're like, well, like, I can't be public about it because of, and I was like, that doesn't sound like a reason to me. That sounds like you have internal shame and we should fix that. So, and I have no shame. So I'm going to be so loud about this to everyone.
Well, we applaud you and appreciate you sharing, being open about this, because while this is a podcast that's about sound and audiology and hearing,
well, it's about whatever we want it to be about.
But it's about spreading awareness and connecting to people. That's why we do this. And so we like tangents like this that talk about personal endeavors and real life. Good. Well said, Eric. So we kept you so much longer than we intended to. And I know you have to go, but we've been enjoying our conversation. Tell everybody where they can find you. I mean, if they want to see you on Wicked or if they want to follow you on social media, where can they connect with you?
You can connect with me. I am Megals_Daugherty on both Instagram and TikTok. And I've been posting a lot recently. And then, of course, I'm at the Gershwin. So. And then you can hear me on the Wicked soundtrack.
And we'll link in the description of the episode to all of that. I have one last question, because we're audiologists and because hearing is important to singing. Is there anything specific you do in relation to caring for your ears and your hearing as part of your professional work?
I do try to be really conscientious of not cranking up anything too much. I try to use the noise cancellation feature on my headphones so that I can have the volume be lower, especially living in a place like New York City that is so loud all the time. And then also, and I do think that this is part of my caring for myself, I actually don't really take the subway that much. I bike everywhere because I find that I don't have to kind of drown out as much sound when I'm not like rattling through the subway rails. And it's easier to be a bit more calm. And then I can come home and be calm with not a ton of sound. And I watch all my TV late at night when my husband's asleep. I don't have to keep the volume down anyway.
There you go.
Listeners, you heard it here. Don't have your earphones up too high.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Meg, for coming on, sharing your story about your professional life, your personal life, and everybody check out Wicked, both the musical and the soundtrack. I went to go try to see Wicked about 2 weeks ago and it didn't work out. We're going to go again.
Yeah, try January. January and February is a great time to go see Wicked. That's way more calm. It's not Christmas time in New York right now. It's crazy out there.
My New Year's resolution 2025, I will see you in Wicked early next year.
Perfect.
Awesome. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
You're so welcome. This has been an absolute pleasure.
La vida no se detiene cuando te enfermas. Las vacunas contra las enfermedades respiratorias pueden protegerte para que juegues con tu compañero fiel. Según tu edad y tu salud, podrían recomendarte vacunas contra la gripe, el COVID-19, el VRS o la infección neumocócica. Vacunarte puede ayudarte a seguir en el juego. Infórmate en cdeep.org/es/vacunas-protegen. Presentado por The American Lung Association y CVIP, combatiendo enfermedades respiratorias infecciosas.